You're listening to the Allan Gray Podcast. I am Sipisihle Zwane, a portfolio manager at Allan Gray, and your host for this episode. South African listed property has struggled over the last decade, after being one of the great wealth creators the decade before. While COVID made the cracks more visible, with empty office spaces and struggling shopping malls, the challenges predated the pandemic, with slowing economic growth, infrastructure failures, and an unraveling of financial engineering benefits. The sector has, however, started to stage a comeback over the last year. Today, we discuss what's driving this. Is it GNU optimism, interest rate cuts, or deeper fundamental changes to the operating environment, with more to come? Joining me to discuss our views are investment analysts Gitte van Zyl and Umar Kaji. Together, we'll explore what changed over the last decade, current market dynamics, and our view on the longer-term prospects. Welcome, Gitte and Umar. I know it's your first time on the podcast, so maybe just as an introduction, I think it's probably quite interesting to start with you, Gitte. I mean, we talk about property, so more the tangible investments, and your background is probably more tangible than a lot of investment people. So background in engineering all the way to PhD level. How does someone find themselves going to so much school, so much engineering, so much tangible work and background to coming to asset management? How did you get here?
The engineering I studied is industrial engineering, which obviously has a big tangible aspect. But in my postgraduate studies, I specialized in operations research, which kind of the best way I can explain that is finding mathematical ways to optimize. And then my PhD master's was actually in applying machine learning methods to genetic problems, specifically identifying disease genes. So kind of straight from the path from engineering first and then straight off that path again, coming into asset management.
Maybe you, Umar, I think we probably started at UCT at the same time. And I guess you took the longer route, if you call it that, as a CA now. I mean, what was the thinking towards going through, you know, the CA program and studying accounting and then ending up as Allan Gray and also in the investment team here?
I think the journey started back in 2017. I actually had the opportunity of participating in the internship, the winter internship here at Allan Gray. That was my final year of my undergrad. I was trying to get a feel for what I wanted to do, whether I wanted to continue with my accountancy or whether I want to go into investments. It was a period of me, you know, fact-finding. So I came to Allan Gray, and as part of that internship, I got the opportunity to do research on a stock that one of the portfolio managers was interested in. So it was a short internship, so it was a very simple report, and I quite enjoyed it. Then after the internship, when I went obviously back to my studies, I continued. So I started looking at specific stocks to research and invest in my own personal capacity. I kept in contact with the portfolio manager at the time. So then at the end of my undergrad, I had to make the decision. Do I continue with accounting, doing my postgrad, going through with chartered accountancy, or do I, you know, take the opportunity of maybe going into asset management immediately? So I went the accounting route, and it was based on the fact that Allan Gray has the CA program here. So I thought it was a good opportunity to, you know, get my CA qualifications and try and get an opportunity to work in the investment team. And fortunately, I got to spend quite a bit of my articles within the investment team, and that allowed me to learn the process, the philosophy, and, you know, how it feels to work with these smart people in Allan Gray. And I enjoyed it. And at the end of my articles, I made the decision I'd like to apply for this role. And I was fortunate enough to get that role. And this is where we are today.
Perfect. I mean, one thing I found is that everyone has very different journeys to getting here. And I think it's quite helpful and cool to have a team with, like, you know, dynamic and different backgrounds. Maybe to lean on your accounting skills, Umar, maybe tell us a bit about, I guess, the topic today is on property, listed property. And I think of it as just, you know, shares that you buy, not necessarily a different asset class, but, you know, the way it's defined, it's often defined as a different asset class. I mean, for some good reason, and the legislation around that is very different to other listed companies. Maybe just tell us a bit about, you know, REIT legislation. I know not all property companies are REITs, but maybe I think that's a good starting point.
So I'll start with the term that you threw out there, REITs. So it's a real estate investment trust. It's a special vehicle that these companies can construct in order to house the properties within that vehicle and give exposure to various investments. So if you had to contrast it with you investing in a property directly, yeah, you can invest in equity or share-like instrument, but in multiple properties and benefit from the liquidity that a share would have without, you know, buying into the property directly itself. Some of the benefits itself, before I get onto the tax legislation, is that, I mean, buying a property is quite a large sum of capital that you're putting down in individual asset, whereas with a REIT or share-like instrument, it's a lot more divisible. Mm. So you might not own 100% of the property, you might own a very tiny percentage of the portfolio of properties. And that just also speaks to the liquidity nature. But to the core part of your question, the big benefit of investing in these REITs as opposed to investing directly in the property is the tax benefits that can come with it. So REITs receive special tax benefits by virtue of the Tax Act. Notably, if a REIT distributes at least 75% of its earnings or distributable earnings, it is exempt from tax to the extent of that portion that it pays out. So a simple example, if they earn distributable earnings of 75 Rand or 100 Rand and they pay out 75%, they'll only be taxed on the difference, which is the 25 Rand. And I mean, distributable earnings is quite defined within the legislation, and it's specifically property income and expenses that result in a property net profit. So the entity itself is tax exempt, but it's quite important to separate the company's tax implication in you and I as a shareholder in that REIT. So whilst the distribution is tax exempt, when we do our personal tax returns, we'll be taxed at our marginal rate.
Okay. And maybe to talk to you about that term, right? The distributable earnings. I know during COVID, there was a whole woo-ha about it and everyone was forced to pay out earnings, even though the, you know, the debt on the balance sheets was a bit of a problem. There were some liquidity issues with some, you know, tenants not paying any rents. Maybe what should we think about the distributable earnings and then how that relates to cash? You know, is there a difference? Is that the cash that the business gets? Is there some weird funnies there that we maybe don't know about?
I think the idea is actually that distributable earnings should more or less reflect the cash operating earnings underlying. That's the idea. But that's not necessarily always the case. There's often kind of things you can do with accounting that moves distributable earnings up or down without actually impacting the cash operating performance. So a good example of this, or one of the most common examples, is probably expenses being coming through the income statement versus being capitalized. Okay. For example, just very simplistically, if you have a mall and the landlord has to retile that mall, a lot of property companies, they'll capitalize that and say that's CapEx, which means it doesn't hit the distributable earnings. It doesn't decrease that. Whereas if you expense it through the income statement, that does come off. So if you compare company A and company A expenses and company B capitalizes, company B's distributable earnings will look higher, but in reality, actually, their performance might be similar.
And that's why I say I like to think of it as a share, an actual share, and think about the cash flow. Because I guess at Allen Gray, the way we invest is we think of investments as being owners of businesses. So trying to look through accounting and try to think about what's the sustainable cash flow a business can generate over the long term. Another thing that REITs have, I mean, that's different from other companies. You know, other companies, usually you spend on a building or, you know, if you have a warehouse or a car and you depreciate that asset. And property is a strange thing, right? It's very different if you think about it versus other shares that you build a building and then there's some person who comes once a year and they revalue it. And then that's the number you see on the balance sheet. Why is that the case? I mean, should we not have depreciation in property investment? If I build something in Joburg CBD in 1980, should it be worth the same thing now versus what it was then? Should we revalue it all the time? Should there be a depreciation? Do we trust the people who are valuing these things as well?
Okay, that's one question. I think we can put that aside for now. But I think what makes property different to, say, a car or a laptop or something, the kind of asset that you typically depreciate, is obviously the base of value of something is supply-demand balance. And the thing with property is that the supply of land in the right location is fixed. You can't add to that supply as easily as you can for certain things like a car or a laptop. So I think that makes determining the value of a property how many years into the future more difficult than that kind of asset that you can depreciate. But of course, if you build a property now and for 50 years, you don't invest in maintaining that property or anything like that, you're going to have a dilapidated property. And at least in real terms, it's going to be worth much less than it was when you built that property.
You can take it from where it comes. I mean, a lot of these properties are funded with debt, right?
Okay.
And I mean, I've been in the property market now personally, so I've gone through the process of, you know, getting a mortgage against the property. And they take it very seriously to determine what the current value of that property is.
Mm.
So in my case, it was, you know, they went to go see the property or they got the details of the current lease and they were able to do their own valuation of the property to ensure that there is value for which the mortgage can be secured against, right? So, I mean, these banks do a similar thing for this REITs. They have this massive portfolio of properties. There's debt funding behind it. So it would be quite onerous for the bank to give a mortgage today if it's relying on a property value from, as you said, the 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there has to be a certain kind of value that is underpinning it today so that if some onerous event happens and they need to dispose of that property today, they need to know what is the kind of recovery they can get in order, you know, to compensate for the loan they gave.
Okay.
That touches on the property valuations. Do we believe them
or not?
Yeah. Obviously, there's a whole process, and often the REIT valuations that they report in their books, that's not their valuation, internal valuations. Mm-hmm. It's external, independent valuers. The value for a property should reflect the income that you think you're going to generate in the future.
Mm.
And in the event where you have something like COVID, and now you have this massive oversupply in office, which is already starting before that, but now it got much worse. In that event, the property has to be worthless.
Mm.
But what we saw is that the valuations kind of took a really, really long time to reflect that adjustment in kind of the expectations for the income the property will be able to generate. So, and then another way you can kind of look at, do these valuations, should we believe them, is you can look at the value that the shares are trading at, because most of them tend to trade, or at least in the past couple of years, at a fairly big discount to the net asset value, which kind of gives you an idea that the market overall doesn't really believe in these valuations. In general, we kind of think the property values are maybe a little bit overstated.
Yeah. I guess it's a very big difference over time, right? So if we looked at property investments coming from, I guess, the early 2000s, you had a lot of underlying fundamentals that were great, right? But also at the same time, the financial part of it was amazing for the company. So you had companies trading at a premium to their net asset value,
mm-hmm.
Which is a great thing to do. So if your assets minus your liabilities, the market was placing a higher valuation on that. So if your asset minus your liabilities is 100, people are willing to pay 150 for that.
Mm.
So what does that mean is that the things like funding property purchases with debt become much cheaper if your cost of capital, which would effectively, if you're on a premium to NAV, your cost of capital is a bit lower. So what you can do is I pay you a dividend. So I pay you 10 Rand today. I come back to you next month and I ask you for that 10 Rand back. I raise some money from you. When that 10 Rand comes into my company, the market values it at 15 Rand, right? Because on a 1.5 times multiple to book. So I can raise money in the market very cheaply. I buy properties with that and I grow very fast. Whereas now, I guess the big change, which we'll get to in the fundamentals as well, is that's gone, right? So Kitsa, you mentioned that the premium to NAV is gone because people, to some extent, worry about the valuations. Maybe the interest rate is a bit higher. So a rand of debt does the same thing to NAV, whether the interest rate is 20 or 1, you know? So maybe the interest rate is higher, so people want to pay something different. So maybe if you go from the early 2000s, so you had this amazing time, right? So high interest rates, which came down, retail growth in South Africa, everyone wanted to open a shop right everywhere. You know, there's bars opening all around. See less of that now. And then there's NAV benefits, this financial engineering benefits, and a lot of that unwound. So, I mean, that's cleaned up to some extent. Why are we not invested now? Why aren't we, you know, big shareholders in these companies when the big NAV benefit is gone? And maybe now you could say that investments are being driven more by the underlying performance of the properties versus the financial benefit.
When constructing our portfolios, there's always an alternative investment opportunity.
Mm.
All right. So it's not looking at the absolute return opportunity, but you need to peg it against things like bonds that could achieve very similar return metrics, or versus other equities, whether they can achieve a rate of return that is, you know, a lot more favorable from a risk-reward point of view. So, I mean, at the time, I mean, if I had to look 2 years ago when interest rates started increasing, and looking at these property companies, their dividend yields did increase alongside the government bond yields. I think some of them were above 11-12% at some point. But I mean, the government bond yields were also offering such attractive returns at the time. So then you have to ask yourself, so why would I invest in a listed property company versus a government bond? Then you have to start factoring in risk. So the property companies had very specific issues, whether that's the vacancies we saw in Sandton and office blocks, or the fact that they were unable to renegotiate their lease terms on favorable terms as they did in the past. So there was this added risk or uncertainty, and maybe the balance sheets weren't great. As you know, you have a government bond, you have the security of the government or the treasury behind you. So one can justify the investment property if there's like substantial growth opportunities to grow that earnings over time. And I mean, there were a lot of issues at the time, as I discussed, like the ability to renegotiate these leases on favorable terms. Vacancies were higher. They've improved, but not the kind of improvement that you would expect to take it back to pre-COVID levels. So, I mean, at the time, yeah, there's this high starting yield that you're being promised, but how does that evolve over time? And is there a risk that it deteriorates over time? It wasn't quite obvious at the time that property was like the best one to go to. I mean, we were wrong. I mean, property did outperform over some period over the past 2 years. But I know things are changing right now, and these property stocks have started selling off again.
I think it's also our funds are quite large, and well, some of the companies are, relative to our funds at least, quite small, which does make it difficult or limit our options in terms of the number of companies that are large enough to build up a meaningful position size that's actually big enough to move the needle, and how long it takes to do that. So it's liquidity constraints as well to some extent, and yeah, just general kind of portfolio construction constraints. And I also wanted to touch on something Umar mentioned with vacancies. Most of the REITs, there are exceptions, but especially the larger ones, they own office, residential, kind of a mix of the type of properties. And office in particular, which I know people talk about a lot, but they do still have high vacancies. We are still seeing high negative reversions. And reversions being when you renegotiate this lease, you're saying this was the rental we agreed upon, and now on renewal, a negative reversion would be, okay, now it's 10% lower. So you're still seeing fairly big negative reversions coming through. And that's unlikely to change until there's a better supply-demand balance in office. Essentially, at this point of time, it's not clear when we're going to get to the point where the economy grows fast enough to add sufficient jobs to get to the point where office vacancies are actually filled.
I think our CIO, Duncan, sometimes say that the best time to buy certain types of shares is actually when they're a bit more expensive. And I think property was one of those. When they're more expensive, they're able to raise money in the markets at a cheaper rate. And I think one thing you mentioned about the distributable earnings is that what tends to happen is that companies pay out all their cash flow before spending on growth or buying new things. So then how do you grow? You get a bank loan and you hope that your valuation of your properties goes up so you can gear up on that again. So it's very important on growth. And then you ask your shareholders for more money. And if you can get that at a cheap price, then it's very helpful. I think maybe a big change now is that all of a sudden when you lose that benefit, we start to look at properties on their actual fundamentals. So you've lost the juice on top or the cherry on top of financial engineering. And now we're like, what are these actual properties doing? And maybe we can get to a few of them. I mean, we can break down the spaces. But maybe first, in the world right now, everyone's worried about recessions and things like that. And if you had to ask some people, they'd be like, properties have contractual rentals. So even if the economy, you know, if GDP falls 3% tomorrow, Click still has to pay their 5-6% higher rental next year. How do you think practically in reality, and it was a similar thing with inflation where everyone thought, oh, if inflation is high, it's a hard asset, it should go up with inflation. I mean, how do you think properties evolve or perform in different economic circumstances? So maybe one big one is obviously a recession. How should properties perform in a recession? Yeah, everyone thinks of it as defensive, but maybe it's not always defensive, right? It wasn't as defensive during COVID.
I think one thing that I've come to appreciate about these property companies is that you cannot be too disconnected with the underlying performance of the tenant itself. So, I mean, retail shopping centers and a retailer as a tenant is a good example. So whilst the in-force leases have these built-in escalations of, what, 6 to 7%, and you might achieve that kind of rent increases within the lease, but if the underlying retailer has turnover within that store growing at, I don't know, 2, 3, 4%, which has been the case in the weak economy that we've had over the past, I don't know, decade. By the time you get to negotiations, like, the tenant's going to come to the table and say, look, things are really tough for me. The margins on the retailers are really thin to begin with. And if your top line is only growing at, what, 3, 4%, but then your occupancy costs are growing at 6, 7%, then add some load shedding costs, diesel costs. I know it's not a case now, but it was a case a year or two ago.
You still add the ESCOM escalations, right?
There we go. The tariff is going at, what, teens. I mean, that margin gets squeezed and the tenant's going to say, look, this is not sustainable. And this is where that whole concept of a negative reversion comes in. It's like, now in this new lease, let me take a hit down on the rent and then we can start again. So in reality, if focusing within the lease as opposed to across multiple leases subsequently, I mean, I don't think rental income actually is quite inflation as people think it is.
We see, especially in retail, the large retailers becoming a larger and larger proportion of your rental income. So their bargaining power just keeps increasing relative to the landlord who's operating in an environment where maybe there's not really as big a shortage of supply, and your bargaining power just gets eroded over time.
Yeah.
I mean, these anchor tenants know it, right? They know that they occupy such a large degree of the space within the center, but they're also the main driver for people going to the shopping centers. So they can just strike one of the best deals. I mean, we don't have the numbers, but a lot of them could be loss making to a landlord, right? In order to get that footfall and maybe benefit from the peripheral tenants.
But they're also the only ones rolling out new stores. So you kind of have to accommodate
them. So it's like, a lose-lose situation. You have to have them, but they're the only ones that's willing to take up the vacant space.
Yeah. I think the concept of a occupancy cost ratio is quite interesting. To an outsider, it's the first thing you look at is obviously your rents are increasing, and then you look at the reversions, are they going up or down on the renewals after your 3 or 5 years, however long your lease is. But then there's this other huge thing that's been a bit of a mess for a lot of companies in South Africa, not just property companies, that, you know, your municipal costs in general have been increasing. So be it water, not necessarily the increase in the water cost, but maybe you building stuff to be more robust to water disruption effectively. And, you know, things like security costs and big increases in insurance post the KZN riots or KZN Gauteng riots. Insurance and security in costs have increased a lot. Then there's obviously energy, right? And a lot of people bought out their load shedding solutions. But then you still have the Eskom stuff that you can't really get off at the same time. Or maybe your municipal office won't allow you to get off the grid completely as well because you're so important to their revenues. It is interesting that it's not just inflation, but it's all these costs. And what does that do to the ability of the retailer to survive? And I think the underlying thing that needs to grow is actual revenue. So retail revenue and trading densities actually need to grow for it to make sense. Maybe if you speak about retail, I think that's probably a good space to start. Do you guys have a sense of what's happening to space? You know, every single presentation that you see of some of the very big retailers, they want to grow as many stores as possible. It feels difficult to imagine everyone growing stores in this environment, and is there like enough more space for it? Where they're going to grow all these stores? Do you have a feeling for what's happening there, and what does that mean for rentals going forward?
Yeah, I take your point. I actually thought about this a lot, and it is difficult to see because you don't see new malls going up that's going to create these new spaces, and it feels like that wouldn't be a very financially prudent decision to actually go and do that. What I will say is that you do see certain things, like there are some retailers reducing space. So some of that is the retailers are growing, taking up space and that. And then there's also kind of optimization happening where you have certain retailers taking up really large spaces at the moment. And then those spaces kind of being subdivided.
So I think the situation like maybe a year or two ago is very different to the situation today. I mean, throughout COVID, the quantity of new space being added to the industry slowed down quite significantly. I mean, there's a few metrics that we look at, like the building plans passed through the council or the municipality. And there was definitely a slowdown after COVID as people realized, I mean, vacancy are increasing. The situation is quite dire. Do I really want to open up a store? But now, I mean, like across the industry, vacancy rates in retail has come down quite significantly. So, I mean, I mean, the prospect of adding a new shopping center, I mean, it has to be the right location. It's not like you can add a new supply at the same rate as some of these retailers are hoping to open, whether it's ShopRite or these other retailers.
I guess that space growth might also be in a different format. Yeah, what we think of when we think about the REITs, we think about these big, massive malls, regional, super regional malls, whereas the space growth will probably be more convenience kind of centers, which I don't know how big the opportunity in that is, how lucrative it would be to build all these tiny little convenience centers.
I mean, one thing about space that always interests me, if you've been to Canal Walk over the last year and a bit, you'd think that Pep doesn't have any more space to open because they're everywhere. Every little small Dorpy has a Pep. And then you see that Pep in Canal Walk and it's always packed.
Yeah.
And it's always moving quite a bit. So, I mean, I think a lot of the landlords have almost changed their views on what's the right stores to have. And I think there's more of a realization on the SA macro, and the super regionals are not being as fancy as they used to be and willing to get the stores that actually get the footfall. Maybe like another thing that's interesting is the performance of the different types of malls, right? So you get these super regionals that charge massive rents and have Louis Vuitton and Gucci and things like that. Then you have these smaller regional stores, and you have this the actually small neighborhood ones. Maybe talk to, like, I guess the different impacts macro-wise on those. I mean, you find that if you have a very big food as your overall tenant base, if that's a bigger share of it, very different macro or sensitivity to the macro versus the super regionals. What's the right space to be in at the moment? Should we be invested in companies that have these massive super regionals? Should we be in Gucci or should we be in Pep? Which tenants do we want?
One of the opinions is based on something we spoke about earlier. Like, as much as ShopRite and all these defensive retailers do sink a lot of space within your mall, like, are you really getting like the best deal for that space?
Yeah,
it's a tricky question. Whereas, like, if you have like a Louis Vuitton, as much as the footfall is a lot lower, I mean, the trading densities of some of those stores can be quite high, and then, you know, those tenants might be willing to pay up for that specific space. So, as a landlord, it might be quite lucrative to have like a Louis Vuitton or a Gucci as your quote unquote anchor tenant versus a ShopRite, right? You can charge a much higher rent. So, I mean, it's a case by case, I think.
But I think at the end of the day, it ties back to what you're saying. It comes back to what's the underlying performance of that retailer. So where's the growth? Who's going to grow?
Yeah.
If it's the ShopRite or the Pep, or if those are the retailers going to grow, and or that market is going to grow, that's probably the way to go. Even if Gucci is I'm going to call it a margin, you can ask for a lot higher rent and your expenses are similar. Even if that's much higher and that market's not going to grow, then I don't know.
I think, I mean, a good comparison is looking at, I mean, the super regional malls like the Waterfront, Canal Walk, and how they've performed to like just the regional malls, the smaller malls. And the super regional malls recovered a lot quicker and are performing a lot better today, whereas the regional mall, which is more, I suppose, are your defensive tenants that are staying there, because you can't add many tenants given the size of the mall. So, I mean, it just attracted a different cohort of shoppers, right?
Fair.
And then ultimately, I mean, the trading density came through because people spent money at these super regional malls as opposed to these regional malls. It's a bit of a tongue twister. and that filtered through into the rents, whether it's on negotiation, like the negative reversions came down a lot quicker and then translated into positive reversions.
But I also think the super regional mall market, in quotes, is probably saturated.
So you made a good point on thinking about the market and where what's growing faster. And, you know, a lot of the landlords had to do a lot of hard work in reducing their Edgar's base in the past. And, you mean, I probably saw it in under reversions as well. So I guess that is a very important thing. You just need to know your market and what makes sense in your specific market. Maybe another thing that's been, you know, challenging for a lot of retailers in general, online and delivery, I guess. Online clothing in South Africa is a bit more tricky, you know, sizing is tricky, returns are tricky, maybe postage is tricky, but online food and delivery and that, I know a lot of retailers are talking about where is the revenue generated. So, you know, a lot of retailers will pay a revenue-based rental to some portion. And if I am, you know, an online delivery person, I'll say, oh, this is not generated in the store. We sold this thing on the bike. It's not actually, or we sold it online on the app. And then if I'm the landlord, I'll be like, oh, but this guy came in and took the stuff from my store. Do you think online is a big threat, I guess, to some senses in South Africa going forward?
Oh, that's a difficult question. I think discounting online as a threat in South Africa would be very naive. I can't tell you how high penetration will go is influenced by different factors, including kind of the distribution network and the wealth of the people living in the country, the spending power. In terms of what we've seen so far, online hasn't been the tailwind to industrial or like logistics kind of DC assets that we've expected. So, and that's probably because we are still seeing most of the, for example, food retailers, a lot of the, most of those orders are still being filled out of the store. Yeah. I would think if penetration increases significantly, that eventually we have seen a lot of that moving to like dark stores, in which case, I mean, that landlord should be earning something out of for the dark store property. But I would think that rental compared to a rental for a retailer in a mall would be significantly lower because you can make that, you can build that in kind of an out of the way location. It's not as prime property. I guess on balance, I struggle to see how significant online penetration isn't bad for rentals over time.
I've asked this question to one of the property CEOs or the REIT CEOs, and they always come up with like the hopeful view that, you know, at the moment, like a lot of the picking, for example, for these retailers happens in store. Or if they do have like a dedicated warehouse, they could be like the landlord of that warehouse. So it's like, it's almost like a mixture from, you know, you, the shopper goes into a retailer to now, you know, shopping online, but then they still need the storage space at the back. It's a bit nuanced, but I'm not quite sure how it actually ends up playing out and whether we get to that level of penetration where it starts putting a dent into retail space.
I mean, one thing we can see in the retail space is that the reversions on rents have been increasingly positive over time, which probably means that we've gotten to the position where the retailers are happy to pay what they're paying, and we have what we call internally, if the space is not over-rented, so the rent is not too high than it economically should be. Maybe in some of the companies that you look at, Umo, you look at Growth Point, they have this amazing asset in the area that we're at now, which is a retail thing, but also just a destination. How do you think about the prospects of that company at the moment?
So, yeah, the waterfront. I mean, I don't view that as a South African property. It's got, it should achieve like international status. So it's actually been quite incredible to see how this thing has outperformed over the past few years. Yeah, I often go walking to the waterfront shopping center, and it's amazing the amount of people that are actually coming to the shopping center. I mean, with all of that, you can definitely see the shopping power coming through and the pricing power from these international visitors coming with their dollars to South Africa. So, I mean, it speaks to my previous point, like, as long as the underlying retailer is doing really well, it's going to come through in the rental. So, I mean, people are spending money at the waterfront, right? The retailers, they are really benefiting with these high turnovers. And then come the negotiations at the end of a lease. I mean, the waterfront can really start pushing up inflation plus type escalations into these rentals. And that's kind of help if the retail rent is based on turnover. So you get that direct flow through from this higher turnover that the retailers are achieving into your leases. It also kind of helps that the vacancies within this precinct is near zero. So, I mean, everyone wants to move. I mean, we speak about the people wanting to move from Johannesburg to Cape Town. And if there is a place you probably want to get your business or even as a resident, it's maybe the waterfront. It's high quality property over here. But if there's no space, I mean, then you really are going to have to bid up for that space. I spoke to a few residents that stay in the apartments, and I think they said that their escalations are like above 10%. I mean, in the world of, what, sub 5% inflation, I mean, you really are competing for that space. So, I mean, you have to think very carefully whether you're willing to pay up for that. But, I mean, as a landlord, it's brilliant, right? If your rentals are going up 10%, but your costs are only going up 6%, I mean, that flow down to your profits is quite significant.
And maybe if we speak about like migration of people, I guess one is, you know, people visiting, so tourists, and then people moving to Cape Town to some extent. And then comparing that to Joburg, and I guess the massive thing in Johannesburg is the amount of office space in the Sandton area. And I mean, I guess everyone was building 5 years out on the expectations of growth and what they're going to do with, you know, employment and how many people they're going to hire. And obviously that didn't turn out as people expected. And now, you know, trying to turn fancy offices into apartments must be very tricky. especially those things that are weird shaped, you know, all those Joburg flagship office spaces that I can't imagine there can ever be an apartment building. A question I always ask myself, and I struggle to get the answers, what solves it? What solves the office space? I know you both look at companies that have excess office space. Is the reality now that we're going to have these 20%, 15% vacancies forever, and they're going to have like bigger coffee areas and, you know, gyms in the in the offices? Or, you know, do we find a way to solve that over time?
Answer to what solves that would be job growth. Mm-hmm. Fill up those offices.
Or just tell people to get back to the office.
Yeah, 100%. Though we have seen increased kind of back to office move. And we've actually talked about it. What's interesting about the back to office move is that as soon as you hit 3 days in office, that's almost effectively back to 5 days from the landlord's perspective. Because you're going to struggle to have hot desks if you have to be in office most days of the week. Then people kind of need a dedicated space. We have seen what you're saying, where you kind of have bigger pause areas or whatever, trying to make it attractive for employees to come back to the office. That's certainly one thing. But then there's also other things that landlords can do. So you do see differences in the experiences, in the reversions and the vacancy rates for these offices. And that is something that you've touched on earlier. Increasing security, increasing security of water supply, electricity, those kind of things. And we've also seen the vacancy rates in P grade, which is like the highest grade properties, they are much better than when you go down to B grade, C grade properties. So I think what we'll probably see is that maybe continue to improve and it almost staying bad or even worsening in the lower grade properties because rentals have come down so much, companies can afford to pay a higher rent and be in a nice office.
I mean, I remember looking at the office property during like the middle of COVID and I was thinking at the time, like, when working from home was such a big thing, coming into office one, like, where does this end up? Like, do these offices in Sandton just remain vacant forever? And I remember joking with that same CEO that I mentioned earlier. And what is like the solution? We're not having this job growth that we see. It's very possible that working from home is like the new reality going forward. Do these remain open forever? And I posed the question to him, like, if you had two offices next to each other and they both had 40% vacancy, is there like an incentive to move all the tenants from the one building to the other? And I don't know, put locks and shut down the other building on like a care and maintenance, just like to force yourself to take out the supply. And I mean, it was a reality. I mean, no one wants to do that, right? But I mean, once a building is up, and especially if it's a competitor that owns a building and there's this vacancy across the entire region, you're all competing with that for that marginal tenant. You have every incentive to have this big negative reversion if it means you can fill up that space. So it's almost like this adverse outcome of having 15% vacancies within a node that you're always just competing with one another, trying to fill up the space. So as Geeta said, like, I think the true solution is, as you said, economic growth.
Yeah.
We need people to actually occupy that space, not playing this funny game of me competing with you, trying to get the tenant. Because at the end of the day, it's probably like a lose-lose situation in that prisoner's dilemma.
If you have empty buildings, it's a very scary place to be, and that tends to probably drive down the value for everyone else around there. Maybe other parts that are interesting, I guess, there's a lot of companies that have multiple asset classes, you call them, if you call them that. So one, we've spoken about retail, we've spoken about office. Maybe part of logistics is storage things. How much space is there for those sort of businesses to grow? It shouldn't be difficult for me to, like, you know, get a few crates from somewhere and you know, get a yard somewhere and you can store your fancy furniture there. Why should I, you know, pay up to store my furniture? And a similar thing, I can just build a little logistics warehouse thing if I get some land. You know, why should I pay up for those sort of things?
Yeah, so I'll take the storage question because I quite like the business model and we don't own in the fund and those constraints that we spoke about earlier, like maybe it's too small and the liquidity is not great, are contributing factors to why we don't own it. But I like the business model. I mean, the storage property companies in the US have been huge winners over the past 20, 30 years.
Okay.
Like the total returns from some of those companies are actually quite unbelievable. And I mean, in studying some of those and trying to see whether that applies to the African context, I mean, there's certain trends that have been unfolded, like moving from living in houses to living in apartments. And apartment, you don't have that same degree of storage space. So you take out external storage space in a unit nearby to your residence. There's an element of hoarding. I mean, people tend to hold on to things longer than they like, but you know, you don't want a cluttered space to live in, right? So, I mean, some apartment blocks have like a dedicated storage unit, but maybe it's not enough. There's also like a security element. I mean, we've all seen some of those dodgy storage units on the fringe of a small town. Whereas like storage is like quite a formal version of the storage. Okay. Security is better. They're in good location. So it's like it gives people a degree of comfort. And I think the nice thing that I've noticed with storage specifically is that the way they can pinpoint the right price for same, what, 3x4 square meter units in different areas. And it's actually quite amazing that they actually try and fit the, I suppose, economic demographic of the various regions. Mm. I thought it was quite an interesting business model. It was trading at the same dividend yield as some of the other property companies, but it didn't have the problems such as high capex. It's very low maintenance. Mm. You don't have those long leases. It's like short-term leases. So you don't deviate from the underlying reality of the people using them. Like I spoke with retailer where there can be the disconnect. So, I mean, you had this like stable growth, low maintenance. So a lot of that revenue goes straight down to the bottom line. And then there was opportunities like storage was in a very early space, which is retail has quite played out its life of growth. So, I mean, it's still quite early days. I think it's a very interesting company and something I do talk about quite frequently with some of the portfolio managers in the team.
South African businesses are, or property businesses are like arbitrage on things not working great. So if you have like better security, you can charge more for that. Or if you have water supply security, or if you have energy security, which is what the malls and office space is doing, if you have higher grade office space that's more comfortable, then you can almost price for that. So it seems like there's a move towards... you know, trying to premiumize. Quite interesting, but I guess you need economic growth to like be more broad-based and those sort of things.
I think what's also interesting about something like storage is, at least for kind of when things get difficult economically, maybe not long-term, but over kind of short-term, there's kind of a little bit of a benefit there because maybe people have to downsize, go into like a little bit of a smaller space. So you kind of have that where others struggle more, like the retailers, you kind of get a little bit of a
Anti-cyclical
benefit,
I guess the logistics is another one that's been quite interesting. I feel like the stock of logistics space in the past was probably like sucked. Like it was like old buildings that weren't safe. And if you're able to just build something with like, you know, bigger yard size, more security, it looks a bit better. It has the licenses you need for certain types of goods. It seems like people are able to price for that if you're in a good node as well.
Yeah, the most important thing I would say is still the location in a good node. There's a limited supply of land in the right location. And also another thing that, and this is the case for other types of properties as well, but it's time consuming and a lot of effort to get basic services like water and electricity to your properties. So those kind of things create a big barrier of entry. But I would say the main thing, especially in industrial, is still having your properties in close to the key kind of transport nodes. Essentially, at the moment, most of that land is already owned by somebody. Mm-hmm. And we all kind of see e-commerce coming in, or anticipate that land becoming more and more valuable. So if you're going to buy, you're going to buy at a very high price.
The other thing, I guess we have, depending on what day it is, sentiment that's a bit better about South Africa versus the past, depending on the day, of course. If you had to go back a few years ago, everyone wanted to send money offshore and everyone was buying stuff offshore. And there's some success, like NEPI was a great success. And there's some things that were less than successful. What's your thoughts on the sort of the appropriateness of South African property companies investing offshore? I mean, maybe my thoughts first is that I guess when we can, in multi-asset funds, invest 45% offshore, maybe it's not as useful as it was in the past. And I guess it helped them in the past because they had funny financial structures that made the distribution higher than what it should be at the cost to the growth of net asset value. I mean, what's the thinking now of the foreign investments in some of the companies that you look at?
In some of the property companies, it's actually hurting them having these offshore investments and using the South African balance sheet to fund it. Because, I mean, property overseas, I mean, there are certain regions and certain sectors that are actually struggling quite a lot. Read a few statistics earlier today about the office vacancy in like San Francisco and Manhattan. And if you think San Antonio is bad, I mean, go check some of those stats. Like you imagine 1/3 of your space being empty. And I mean, if you've invested and geared up your balance sheet for that investment, let's say those properties aren't paying a dividend, like how are you going to finance the debt, right? If you're not getting the income from overseas into your SA holdco. So it almost now it's like the time like where they're actually feeling the pain. Like it was great while the tide was rising, but now it's like really you left bare and you didn't know what to do.
And it's also you had a period offshore where you had like very low interest rates for a very long time. Mm. And to some extent it was easy to gear up that balance sheet and still have your debt metrics at an acceptable level.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden interest rates kind of shut the lights out and a lot of companies had to take some serious measures to try and address that debt and to be able to continue servicing their debt. And what we did actually see is, well, first of all, the valuations for a lot of the offshore properties fell quite dramatically, not all of them, but some. And some companies had to do asset recycling and sell a lot of those properties at quite a big discount to the historical values.
It's almost something that is not clear, obvious, but, you know, being a South African investor, there's a real cost to money, and there's always been a cost to money. Mm-hmm. So the decisions we make are based on, you know, economic fundamentals. When interest rates are too low, a lot of strange things can happen, and valuations of assets that are yielding gets like bid up way too high. And then when that changes, it's been a very painful time for, I guess, the global property players. Maybe thinking about that, and I mean, we talk about property in a multi-asset portfolio in the sense. How should we think about valuing these companies, right? So first you have a net asset value and people think of multiples on that. But, you know, a net asset value has an input, which is the property value. And we generally don't want to use other people's values to start our value, right? And then you have these distributable incomes that can vary depending on the method that companies choose to look at it. So how would you think of valuing it? Is a company on 8% dividend yield cheap, for example? Or it's not that simple? I mean, how do you think about valuing it?
Yeah, it's never that simple. The first thing I would do is think, okay, it's on an 8% dividend yield. How reflective is that dividend yield of the future dividend yield? And how sustainable is that dividend yield? If I knew that they would be able to pay the 8% dividend yield into perpetuity and I knew the dividend would grow X percent into perpetuity, that would be much easier.
Mm-hmm.
But that's almost never the case. So I think the starting thing is to start with distributable earnings that we touched on, kind of adjust for the accounting funnies, try and get a nice clean number of what I think will recur and what reflects the true underlying performance. And then, like we do for other companies, look at the fundamentals in the segment and try and think what we think growth will be from there.
And I think, I mean, historically, a lot of these companies, or the way the market valued these companies, is that they thought, as you said, what is this dividend? And we just put a yield on it. But given that, I mean, that a lot of companies are really looking at their portfolio and whether the property or the subsector of property fits within their portfolio, there is quite a focus on the actual valuation of those properties. I mean, as we said, the share price is trading at a big discount to the net asset value. As a team, we don't really rely on one type of valuation. We try and find different angles to the valuation. I mean, a good example is like, yeah, we say the property stocks are trading at a discount to NAV. But I mean, there have been good instances that they've been able to actually sell the underlying properties at close to NAV, even though the NAV's come down or the asset value's come down. They've still been able to achieve that asset value in a realization scenario. So, I mean, should it still trade at a discount to NAV? I mean, that's up for debate.
Mm-hmm.
Growthpoint now recently sold the UK property business. I mean, there's maybe some increasing thought about whether they should be in specific regions entirely. Mm-hmm. So then do we do like a sum of the parts where like you value the Australian business, which is also listed on the Australian Stock Exchange, or the Eastern European business very differently? Do I include Waterfront in the South African portfolio for Growthpoint, or do I put it on like a premium multiple in valuing that company? So previously I would have thought, oh, you get this dividend from Growthpoint and you put a yield in it. But now I'm increasingly thinking about how the different parts within the company is being valued,
okay,
and whether that will ever be appreciated by the share price over time.
Yeah,
I think the other thing is also in an industry like this where we do still see kind of challenges that are probably going to remain, like the electricity costs, having to invest more and more, water security is becoming a bigger and bigger problem, and that's quite expensive and more difficult to fix. For something like that, you want a fairly big margin of safety.
And I think that's the reason why we haven't bought into the property sector quite yet, or why we remain underweight, is that, I mean, the issues, as Geeta discussed, are still persisting today. So you have to really measure it up against the other opportunities.
Yeah, I guess at the end of the day, the way we think about businesses is, would you own this at the price that it's trading at? And you know, things like sustainable cash that you can get out of the business without taking too much strain on the debt part. So I guess the tricky part of property has always been too much cash coming out, not enough being reinvested in. And when it does get reinvested in, what does that do to the long-term sustainability? Maybe the growth is something you can do when interest rates are lower or when your cost of, you know, getting money from your shareholders is lower. But what happens when that slows down? And I guess that's been the case over time and a big reason why we've been underweight. But I guess you always sharpen your pencils. And now we're thinking more about, you know, the actual fundamentals of the properties, what's driving that, the retail earnings, longer term, what happens with that, and, you know, the nodes and whether the actual properties are decent. So I think always looking at the actual fundamentals and looking deep at what we're actually buying and what we own when we, you know, investing in property companies. Maybe as a final question to you both, if you had to be forced to choose one asset class to own for the next 20 years or one type of property to own within the next 20 years, what would it be?
I would probably prefer logistics. E-commerce penetration is still fairly low. Like I said, I think it's naive to think that it's not going to increase. We haven't seen such a big tailwind from that yet, but I think, or at least in the listed space necessarily. But those properties have actually done better than some of the classes, and I think that should continue going over the long term.
Yeah, I think storage has a good case. And as much as it's a small company, I mean, we don't shy away from taking big stakes in small companies, as long as like it's a good business run by honest and strong management teams, and we have a good feel for what the valuation is today versus how it can evolve over time. I mean, there's very few examples of like South African companies actually having the ability to compound the intrinsic value over time. And maybe self-storage might be that opportunity because we're so very early in that growth story. I mean, I like storage of all the property companies. I mean, whether or not you agree with me, I think that's one that I would own.
This brings us to the end of episode 25. Thank you, Umar and Gitza, for joining me, and thank you for listening. In this conversation, we discussed changes to the listed property market over the last decade, our views on prospects going forward, and how we think of the asset class in a multi-asset portfolio. If you'd like to get in touch, please send an email to info@allengray.co.za. Subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcasting platform to be notified of new episodes. Lastly, Allen Gray is an authorized FSP. To view our terms and conditions, please visit allengray.co.za. Until next time, I'm Sipisihle Zwane. This podcast was produced by Volume Podcast.
Time. When you're a kid, it moves slower than a sloth trying to get through airport security. There is just so much of it. Skip forward a few years to your 20s. Time is still your friend. It says have some balance. Go party and have fun. Then your 30s hit. And time suddenly steps on the accelerator like it's trying to catch a traffic light before it goes red. 40s. Now time is moving faster than your 10-year-old on a sugar high. 50. You're desperately trying to save as much as you can, but time is moving so fast. And all you can think is, where did all the time go? That's why after 50 years of investing, we've learned that time is the greatest gift of all. And the good news is, if you invest early, time gives you money. And then money gives you more time for some much-deserved you time. Now, isn't that a compelling enough reason to invest? Allen Gray, long-term investing. Allen Gray is an authorized FSP.